Good afternoon, gentlemen. Are you ready to proceed?
We are.
Yes, ma'am.
Our clerk will call the second case, please.
The court will now call City of Forest Hill, Texas, and Bridget Mathis versus Michelle Benson in her official capacity and individually. May it please the court, Mr. Robert Morris will argue for the appellant. Mr. Harold Hammack will argue for the appellee.
Good afternoon. I am Robert Maris. I am here today representing the City of Forest Hill and Bridget Mathis. This case has to do with the election process and statutes that regulate the elections in the state of Texas, specifically the period of time during which a party may challenge an application to run for a political office. The facts of this case are not disputed. The timeline, I think, is particularly important, and I would request that the court or the justices take particular note of that. This case started January 22, 2016. Applications were being taken for the municipal elections that were going to be held that year in the city of Forest Hill. Ms. Benson, the plaintiff in the underlying case, an appellee today, created this problem because she chose to run for two different offices.
Well, counsel, let me ask you. I'm looking at 141.033A, which pretty clearly says that you can't file for more than two offices that are not permitted by law to be held by the same person. But there was, as I think of law, I mean, the city ended up having to go to the AG's office to get an opinion that under the doctrine of incompatibility, these two offices couldn't be held simultaneously. But at the time she filed, was there a law that prohibited her from holding both of those positions?
Well, it wasn't clear, and that's why there was not a challenge. Nobody had done this before. These are two seemingly unrelated offices, city council and library board. Nobody, there was no established precedence that says, you know, this creates a conflict, you can't do it. So she was allowed to go forward with her two applications.
Okay, now, but do you think that under 141.033, that on the day she filed those applications, one of the applications was invalid under that particular statute?
Well, had somebody raised the issue, had the city objected to her running for the two offices and refused to allow her on the ballot, then that would have been the result, I think, ultimately, but it hadn't been established at that point.
Right, and I guess her response, had the city raised it then, would have been to say, wait, there's no law that says I can't do this, so you have to accept my applications, right?
She would have taken that position.
Sure, okay.
But she didn't, and the city didn't either. She gets on the ballot for the two different positions, and in May, she wins both races. Later in May, on May 17th, she's sworn into both offices, first the city council position and then the library board. Now, there was an underlying concern about the legality of what she was doing, so everybody, including Ms. Benson on the council, agreed to request that the attorney general look at the situation and determine whether or not there was a problem. That request was made in July of 2016, but no opinion from the AG's office appeared until January 3 2017, the following year. And after the AG looks at the situation, they do apply the doctrine of incompatibility because we're dealing with two offices having the same geographic area and same tax base. So, and it's pretty clear, according to the Attorney General's office, that she could not hold both offices. The law is that if you take a second oath that is incompatible with your first position, then you're deemed to have resigned the first position, which in this case would have been the City Council.
I know that Section 201.025 has been raised in the briefs, but I didn't see that particular statute referred to in either the city's request to Ken Paxton's office or in the AG's opinion as being a basis for why, in the AG's view, when she took that second oath, it had the effect of vacating the first office. Do you know why that wasn't brought up?
I do. No one in this case, neither the city or Ms. Benson, contest the AG's determination that there was incompatibility and that she, therefore, it would be, you would have to follow that that doctrine. So the reason it's not briefed heavily is because nobody disputes that.
Well, I was just curious because I saw it, and I saw that statute referred to in the briefing, but I didn't see it anywhere in the AG material, so I was just confused. Right. But
so, after the AG's opinion is received by the city, the council reacts to it and removes her from her city council position because that's what the law seemed to be at the time. Now, Ms. Benson then initiates a lawsuit, ironically, taking the position that her application with the for the library board, which she voluntarily did, and her ensuing election was all void. And so she made the political determination when she filed her lawsuit in January of 2017 that I like my city council position better, so I'm going to find a way to get rid of this library board, this inconvenient library board position, so that I can remain on council.
Well, yeah. Why isn't that okay under 141.033?
Well, it's not okay because of the doctrine of mootness in section 141.034, which says that if you're going to challenge an application to run for political office, you must do it before the election starts. You can't wait until after the election occurs and then determine that you don't like the application.
So she would basically be challenging her own application before the early ballots were mailed out?
Yes. I mean, she obviously wanted to run for both offices. And so,
but my position, what I'm saying is, why doesn't subsection 141.033B apply that says that if two petitions or two applications for a place on the ballot in violation of the section are filed, each application filed subsequent to the first one is invalid? Why isn't it invalid whether somebody challenges it or not?
Well, it's not self-actuated.
But why not? Why not?
Well, because a court or the AG needs to make that determination. In retrospect, you can look back at the situation and say, well, that the AG's opinion is right. It could have been improper in the first instance, but that determination had not been made. You can't assume that it was going to be not permitted by law. I mean, it's okay to run for two offices as long as those two offices are permitted by law.
And once they're not permitted by law, then the second application is invalid.
Right, but that determination was not made until well after the election.
I'm not understanding why that changes anything. If it's invalid, it's invalid, and to say that it's only invalid if someone files a complaint, what about offices where people are running unopposed or people are, and, I mean, how can it not be, if it's invalid, it's invalid? It doesn't matter whether it's challenged or not. When it's discovered, it's invalid.
Well, because, I mean, if you look at all the cases, you have cases dealing with signatures on petitions. You have irregularities in applications because they're not properly filled out, not properly signed, et cetera. And you have the situation, in this case, with incompatibility. Now, you can't assume, in all the cases that are cited to the court, every one of them, whether they're cited by appellate or appellee, they all were raised prior to the election. Just because you could have raised an issue about the validity of your signatures on your petition or the way you filled out your ballot or where you lived, et cetera. The law is such, with respect to the mootness doctrine, which we have cited in court, you must raise that issue. Applications are a ministerial type function. It's got to be right. But it's not wrong until somebody, a court or an attorney general,
right,
says it's not right.
But we're on the exact same page, because the challenges that you're talking about are not challenges to eligibility. And if she's not eligible to hold both offices at the same time, then eligibility is exempt under 141.034. It says limitations on challenges for applications. This section does not apply to a determination of a candidate's eligibility. So why isn't being, by law, incapable of holding two offices at the same time, why is that not a challenge to eligibility that's exempt from the 141.034 time period before the voting starts?
Well, you must raise the issue before the election. You can't wait until after the election to raise an issue regarding an application. Now, applications are not the same thing as eligibility. You know, eligibility deals with where you live, how old you are you a citizen of the United States, and are you a sufficient.
But there was no defect in her applications. Her both applications were totally fine. No one's challenging that. They're just challenging that she could be on the ballot at the same time for both positions.
That's true. I mean, her applications on their face were okay. But nobody, as of the time of the election, had made the determination that these two positions were in conflict. That determination was not made until later. But the problem with this, the court's interpretation, you know, the court uses this relation back theory that, well, it was in January of the following year, the AG made the determination that these positions were in conflict. And I'm going to relate back. We're going to ignore the fact that Ms. Benson took two oaths that were in conflict. We're going to ignore the election. And we're going to go back all the way to the prior January and make a determination that, well, because the AG in January of 2017 made the determination that these two positions were in conflict, I'm going to relate back to January 6th and ignore all the intervening events. You just can't, as a practical matter, do that. There's no case. The position the trial court took is completely unprecedented. There's no case in Texas that says that if you make a determination after the election that you can go back to prior to the election and clean up the problem. You just can't do that.
And counsel, let me ask you, and I'm going back to what I brought up initially. I'm struggling with how 141.033 and 034 even really come into play, for the simple reason that at the time she filed her two applications, there was no law that prohibited her from holding both offices. So why are we even talking about 141?
There was law.
There's a common law doctrine. So if I'm reading the words of a statute, and there's a common law doctrine that's going to require ultimately a court to opine on it, because AG opinions aren't binding on anybody, So I read this statute as the phrase by law referring to a statute. For instance, the Texas Constitution, which lays out when you can and can't hold two offices. I would consider that a law, or if there were some other statute that addressed this. But I'm just, I'm really struggling with why anybody could even say now, sitting here today, that at the time she filed those applications, there was a law prohibiting her from doing it.
Well, let's look at it this way. I could be negligent in driving my car because of a wreck, but I'm not deemed to be negligent until a court finds that I was negligent.
I have a question, Judge.
Facts and circumstances regarding...
I know he's out of time, but I needed to ask him a question.
Okay.
You may continue your answer, please, sir.
Facts and circumstances regarding the incompatibility issue existed, but it hadn't been determined. Let me see. One of the cases we cited...
Mr. Maris, so I want to ask you a question, even though your time's expired.
Yes.
These elections for the city council as well as for the library board are governed by the local provisions of the statutory setup of the city of Forest Hill.
The charter, yes.
All right, and under the charter, with whom does an applicant, if I want to run for city council in Forest Hill, who would I file an application with?
There is a city secretary. Her name is Henrietta Roberts.
And so the city secretary is the point where both applications, one for city council, one for library board, they have both been filed with the city secretary.
Yes.
And that is the administrative official who then looks at the applications and says, wait a minute, you made a mistake on line 10 here, whatever. Or, okay, I accept this application and you'll be on the ballot. So when you say there is no law determined, you just mean there's no precedent set out for a clear path for evaluation of those two applications at the time they were filed.
Yes.
And once they're filed, then the party that's responsible for taking actions to see that the applications then are processed and the people are listed on the ballot who are, have a application, a proper application file. That's all with the city secretary, right?
Yes.
So when you say there's not anybody responsible, the city secretary is responsible, isn't she?
Indeed, but you would be asking her to make a legal determination that it took the attorney general 6 months to render.
Well, she could have gone to competent counsel for legal counsel for the city, and it might have been falling in your lap.
Yes, I would be speculating as to why that didn't happen. It's not in the record, but I will tell you this, Justice Meyer. The law, case law that we cite, and the election code value the finality of the election process. The 141.034 says if you're going to challenge applications, you need to do it before the election. You can't wait until after the election.
And that's dealing with who's going to be, but that's dealing with who's going to be on the ballot. It's not dealing with who serves after the election.
Right. I mean, who gets on the ballot is something that must be resolved before you get on the ballot. But after you're a officer serving the people, the law of incompatibility applies. It's a different
and that's
issue.
Where the secretary of City of Forest Hill should have gone if she was going to be following the law.
In retrospect, that would have been a capital idea, but it didn't.
Thank you for your presentation, Council.
Thank you. If you would please give Mr. Hammett 2 extra minutes since we went over with you. Mr. Hammett.
May it please the court. I'm Harold Hammett, the attorney for Dr. Benson, the appellee. Mr. Maris and the city ignore what I think is the central question in this case, and if they addressed it, they give the wrong answer. It's been stipulated that obviously that the Attorney General's opinion rendered on January 3rd relates back. The question is, how far back does that retroactivity go? Mr. Maris seems, assumes and has argued to this court and in his briefs, well, that once that retroactivity starts, it meanders back to December 17 when Dr. Benson took the oaths of office and took the second oath of office. And then the retroactivity dissipates there.
It doesn't continue back to the date of the filing of the application?
That's exactly right. That is the answer to it, and that is the whole key to this case,
well,
as I see it.
Would your client be taking the same position if she had filed her applications in reverse order, so that the result would be that she was on the library board under your theory?
Well, I don't know, but I do think that what she wanted to do, it was very clear that she wanted to be on the city council.
Correct.
At trial, that as part of the hearings, that she had been active as a volunteer on the library board, but that the city council was what she wanted to do. Her father had served on the city council. She had her sister, the county court at law judge in Dallas, come over and swear her in to the city council,
right,
before she was sworn into the library board.
But once the AG issued his opinion and said, okay, the first oath that she took for city council is out the window because she later took an oath for an incompatible office, then at that point, if she wanted to be on the city council, she had to go all the way back to the application, right? But the AG could have come out differently. He could have found that there was not an incompatibility in these offices. And then what would your position be on which office she would hold?
I'm not sure I understand the question. If the Attorney General had found no incompatibility?
Right.
If they found no incompatibility?
And I guess she'd be serving in both offices.
In both of them.
Right, right.
Now, retroactivity goes all the way back to the beginning when the applications were filed. It doesn't stop midstream.
Do you have a case on that?
What?
Do you have any cases on that?
I don't have a case. All I have is I'm not trying to be flippant, nope, but that is the English language. I mean, that to me, what it means, once it gets going, they certainly don't have a case that it stops in midstream like they're arguing. Now, as to
Mr. Hammond,
yes,
what effect in the law is an attorney general's opinion?
It is it's influential. You know, it's guiding, but it's not determined.
It's advisory, isn't it?
It's advisory, purely that.
So it's not the law.
No.
It's merely one attorney general's view of what the law is, according to the question asked and as it's phrased in the request for an opinion.
And that's exactly right. And this is where the city created this problem, because it didn't disclose all the facts to the Attorney General when it asked the district attorney to submit this letter for an opinion. It did not mention section 141.033 in the request to the Attorney General, even though they knew about the problem, as you heard Mr. Mayor say. If they'd been fair and wanted to avoid problems, or at least got clarification, they would say, look, you know, we're concerned about 141.033. We have, she was elected to both offices. Maybe they could have said, we don't know which one she filed for first. And then that would have been the case where their attorney general would have been an uncertain factual determination. And it would have, quote, hedged its opinion, saying maybe whether they're incompatible, but as far as whether she effectively resigned would depend on the facts of the order sequence in which she filed the applications. And that the city deliberately failed to do, did not properly alert the Attorney General to all the facts in this case.
Counsel, Mr. Maris said there's not any dispute on time frames. Do you have any dispute on the timetables as presented?
No. Those are all the great facts. Mm-hmm.
So the time frame sets out that she first filed an application for the city council.
Right.
And then later, on the same day, filed an application for the library board.
Right.
and that the election was all held on the same day, so there's not any time frame on that. That was just one election, wasn't there? I mean, one election day.
Right.
And then the oaths of office, there's no dispute that there was that Dr. Benson took the oath of office for city council first.
Right.
And how much time was there in between the taking of the first oath and the
not
taking?
Not much at all. I mean, it occurred on the same day. So this is not clear in the record. It says then she took her oath for the library board. It's my understanding that after the Judge Benson Dallas swore her in to the city council, then they immediately proceeded where she was sworn in to the library board by the city secretary. A matter of minutes.
All right. Thank you.
Well, I'll try to answer any more questions if there are any, but that's all I have. If there are more questions, then I yield the balance of my time back to the board.
I know everybody probably thinks I'm beating a dead horse, but I'm just still really curious. On 141.033,
yes.
You're taking the position that even though we didn't know, or the parties did not know until January of 2017, that the AG, in his opinion, she couldn't hold both offices. You're saying that we should still apply 141.033 and say, well, now that we know she's not permitted by law, she shouldn't have been allowed the previous year to apply for both positions because she wasn't permitted by law to hold them both.
I'm not necessarily going that far. I'm saying it just says her application, 141.033B says, you know, after you file, if you do file for the prohibitive office,
mm-hmm.
any application after the first one is invalid.
Right, but before that language, it says if a person files more than one application for a place on a ballot in violation of this section, so she would still have had to have filed two applications that by law she couldn't hold those offices.
Right, but it there when she filed the second application, then it became invalid. We're just saying that it's not that she should, the city had to stop her. It's just saying that she was improper on the ballots. The ballots should not have been counted for her. It was a vacancy by electing an ineligible candidate.
Right, but at the time of the applications and at the time of the election and at the time she took both oaths, nobody knew that.
Oh, that's correct, Your Honor, and that is my point about the longevity of retroactivity, all these big words. Nobody knew when she was sworn in.
Right.
They were not compatible.
Okay, well, okay. Here, fortunately, the city council, you know, this potential problem was raised pretty shortly after she took both offices. But what about somebody who holds a position that is a four-year term for something and for whatever reason? You know, they've been casting votes all along. Nobody challenged their application to be on the ballot. But lo and behold, somebody wakes up after 3.5 years into their term and says, wait a minute, you know, by law, you shouldn't have been on the ballot. I mean, as a practical matter, I mean, isn't that one reason why 034 gives some sort of certainty before a ballot gets sent out?
No, Your Honor. One, what you were asking first, is that not just anybody can jump up and challenge the validity of a person holding an office. This was filed as a suit for really for the right to title of office. Nobody besides Mrs. Benson or the district attorney or the attorney general under quo warranto could have attacked what the city council did. As a stranger, even an incumbent who is defeated for re-election, has no standing to challenge the outcome of an election.
So you don't think Ms. Mathis could have, either before or after the election, filed any challenge to Dr. Benson's dual applications? Because Ms. Mathis was the incumbent city councilman,
yes,
right?
She was the incumbent. She could, no, and that, at that stage, you know, she was not yet a candidate. You know, the way I view this, you're an announced candidate for political purposes when you say you're going to run. You're an applicant for a place on the ballot until the county chair in the primary accepts your application. Then you become a candidate. Now, Mrs. Mathis certainly could have challenged it if she wanted to, but again, nobody knew, and it would might have been expensive to do it. There might not have been time for the Attorney General to reach an opinion. But the thing about 141.034, you know, as Justice Meyer pointed out, it talks about we've got to be approved the application according to form, content, and procedure. It doesn't say anything about being permitted to be filed. Section 141.033B says, in effect, it's not being permitted to be filed because it's totally invalid.
The only other question I have, I guess, is this particular place on the city council up for election this May?
Yes.
So is this whole controversy going to become moot after May? I mean, what?
Moot? Well, after May. Well, I think, yeah, if her term expires, I mean, I don't know whether Dr. Benson is going to run for re-election or not. I presume that she is. But I think the term of the injunction would be for her term. It can't apply after her term ends and her successor is qualified, whether it's she or someone else.
Mr. Hammond, if I recalled a time when the law was in a whole big series of black books. Do you remember that?
I certainly do, and I still have the ones for the election code. I don't have any of the others.
Well, there's a lot of things in the law, in all of those laws that are reported, even on what we find on computers now, or at least which what we use. But we used to use those black books.
I still do.
And if there's a law lurking around in there that talks about law practice of some rule or whatever, and you don't know it. As a lawyer of maybe 50 years, how long you been practicing?
52.
And you don't know about that law. Would it still apply to you in all your 50 years of practice if it had been enacted before you started in all of the...
I'm afraid so.
And therefore, if you don't know a law, doesn't keep it from being the law, does it?
No.
And so are we charged with proceeding daily when we attempt to follow the law? Not only with the laws that we know about, but also laws that are on the books that we don't know about.
Right.
So how are we arguing here that this law wasn't applicable at the time that these things were filed?
I've not understood, Your Honor. I mean, I think this is, I just wish so much that the city council, instead of rushing to judgment, you know, get setting on 2 days' notice the meeting to... quote, evict Dr. Benson from our council, please. They'd given her the time to appear when, instead of being out of town, where we could have tried to work this out. To me, 141.033 is the automatic challenge to her second application. She didn't need a person to do it. The statute did it for her.
Statute said she can't file another application once she files for city council. She can't file for the library board. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hammett.
Thank you.
Mr. Marish, rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. This issue, it seems to me, boils down to what the law ought to be in terms of the administration of elections in Texas. We have cited N. Ray Sandra Crenshaw, a 2017 Dallas court case, where they say it is well established that an election contest becomes moot and the issue is no longer justiciable once the election process begins. Where voting has begun, we believe the rights of the voters to an accurate, reliable ballot must override the candidate's right to challenge his opponent's insufficient application for a place on that ballot.
141.034 affects that statutorily. Gives you a limited amount of time to resist applications. This relation back thing, and I appreciate Justice Kerr's question about, well, how much time do you have to do this? Now, Ms. Benson waited a year to challenge her own application from January of 2016 to January 2017, but according to this relation back theory, you could do that anytime. You could do it today. An opponent could. Ms. Mathis, disappointed candidate, could do it. There's nothing to stop it according to this relation back theory. It could just as easily relate back from the day of the AG's opinion on January 3, 2017 as January 30, 2018. There's no time limit on it. This, ruling of the trial court, and which is being advanced by Ms. Benson, introduces a strong element of instability into the electoral process. There needs to be finality to ballots. There needs to be finality to elections. You can't into perpetuity find reasons to quibble with it. And going back to the AG opinion, it is just an AG opinion. Justice Meyer points out that the AG opinion is not the law. It's authoritative, I think, is what the cases say. This is an authoritative opinion about what the law ought to be. The AG's not a judge. The AG's not the Supreme Court. He doesn't make the law. He just gives you his best interpretation of what the law is. Therefore, nobody's bound. The parties agreed in to dispose of this case that we would accept the AG's opinion as being authoritative. But this decision, this court renders today, is going to have more far-reaching effect than just the dispute between City of Forest Hill and Ms. Benson. This could allow untold complications and instability in the electoral process. If parties are allowed to dig up problems with signatures on petitions, on the way an application is filled out, months, years after an election is completed, frequently depending on how it turned out. So I would suggest that the law ought to be in favor of stability, request that the court reverse and render judgment for Forest Hill. This case still does make a difference because the court gave substantial attorney's fees to Ms. Benson, which my poor city would just as soon not have to pay. So we would request that the...
Mr. Merrill, so I didn't see cited in any of these cases a similar case to where the issue in the case was a person holding two offices at the same time. This would be the first case on that in the state of Texas?
Yes, you're right about that. You're right. There is nothing. There are other cases where there was multiple applications.
And so when you point out to us as we sit here, you people are fixing to write a first in position law.
Yes.
What this case is about.
That's what makes being a justice on the Court of Appeals exciting.
Yes, sir. Thank you for that. And it is.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Maris. Gentlemen, thank you so much for your arguments here today. They were excellent. We appreciate your help in this case. Your case is submitted.